Thank you very much for the invitation to speak here today. As Sarah said, it's a great pleasure to be back almost 20 years after I've done my LLM here. I remember my time at Cambridge very fondly, and allow me at this stage to remember also Sarah Laiho-Lauterbacht, who sadly passed away earlier this week. I'm also glad to see that sandwiches are still being offered as an incentive for students to attend the Friday lunchtime lectures. So in my lecture today, my focus will be on the International Criminal Court. 2017 is the year in which the ICC turns 15. A teenager, you might say, with all the challenges, fears, and hopes typically associated with adolescence. The elation felt through the international law circles with the coming into force of the ICC statute on the 1st of July 2002 could only be matched by the surprise of many who thought it would be impossible that a statute such as this would manage to attract 60 ratifications required, enabling it to come into being. For this type of treaty, reaching this number only 4 years after the adoption of the statute at the end of the Rome Conference on the 17th of July 1998 was a major achievement. With the ICC in operation, expectations as to what this new institution could or perhaps should do grew disproportionately perhaps to its ability to fulfill them. Before we turn to some of the ICC's main achievements and challenges, it would be important to revisit some of the aims and objectives that a court like the ICC seeks to attain. The field of international criminal justice is laden with grand aims. Some of them are to reinforce the concept of accountability, to end impunity, to bring justice to victims and affected communities, to bring reconciliation, to aid peace and justice, and restore the rule of law. It would be unrealistic to expect that the ICC could, within 15 years of operation, tackle all of the above. The ICC is neither omnipresent nor omnipotent, or, as a dear colleague and friend of mine puts it, the ICC is neither God nor your mother. The court is restricted in its function by the modalities of its constituting treaty, that is the Rome Statute, and the exigencies of its operation. Issues of jurisdiction, budget, organizational efficiency, and political will all play a role as to how the court has performed to date. Having said that, and given the context in which the ICC by definition operates, there are clearly some areas where the ICC has done well and some others where it simply needs to do better. As a caveat at this point, let me remind you that it is not possible to empirically test how many deaths and how much suffering have been avoided or conversely inflicted as a result of the ICC's very existence. Although measuring people's perception of the court and employing performance indicators can obviously help to better appreciate the court's success or lack thereof, I do not intend to engage into a clinical discussion of the pluses and minuses associated with the court's operation to date. I will therefore be unashamedly selective in my approach. Today, 15 years after the beginning of the operation, the ICC is a fully fledged institution with all of its crimes, its rules and procedures agreed to, with some of them also already amended. Let me bring you to 2010, when the definition of the crime of aggression, which had been left out of the statute at the Rome Conference, was agreed upon during the first review conference in Kampala. It will be coming into effect this year, as the requisite number of ratifications of the amendment has already been reached. The rules of procedure and evidence have already been put to good use, and also, perhaps controversially, amended by the Assembly of State Parties. Some might say this was done to accommodate specific state interests, and I'm referring here to the infamous Rule 68, for instance, the rule relating to recanted witness testimony. All of the ICC's organs are in operation, and again, major reorganization is already taking shape. See, for example, the Registrar's Revision Project, aiming to reform the operation of the registry. I'm not going to focus on the many firsts in terms of the court's jurisprudence, which I'm sure you're all familiar with. But I cannot resist but briefly mentioning the significance of the Lubanga case as the first case before the ICC, the award of victims' reparations, the ongoing Onwen trial, the first LRA commander to come before the court, himself a child soldier, the Almadi case involving cultural property, and the Bemba case, just to name a few. As the court develops its own jurisprudence, it starts to leave its mark on international criminal justice. Of course, I'm not going to pretend that this has all been plain sailing. The slow pace of justice, the many procedural setbacks, the collapse of cases, the quality of some of the investigations, witness tampering, the overall cost and length, and yes, I'm referring in, to the number of pages each of the decisions contains, have all come under fire. We could spend a lot of time going through the details of the jurisprudence and the minutiae of particular findings. Instead, I'd like to focus on some of the wider institutional challenges faced today by the court and discuss how I see them affecting the court's success in its future prospects. The first challenge I intend to discuss is that of universality. In that, I will include reconciling the ICC with all regions of the world, with a special mention of Africa. Few would have thought that 15 years after its coming into force, the statute would count 124 state parties amongst its members, particularly given that criminal jurisdiction is traditionally regarded as a reserved domain, a sign of national sovereignty. Every new ratification of the statute, including the most recent ones, those of Palestine and El Salvador, constitutes welcome progress towards universality. However, as a firm believer in international criminal justice, it is difficult for me to accept that an overwhelming majority of the world's population is excluded from the jurisdiction of the ICC, other than when a situation is referred to the court by the UN Security Council. As we have seen, however, with the repeated failure to refer the situation in Syria to the court, the Security Council can often be deeply divided when dealing with issues of criminal justice. In addition, 4 out of 5 most populated states in the world, China, India, the United States of America, and Indonesia, are not yet ICC state parties. Supporters of the ICC system of justice must work towards the universal ratification of the Rome Statute. It is important that government institutions working together with global civil society continue to call upon states which have not yet done so to ratify the Rome Statute, including members of the UN Security Council. However, given the current international political climate, allow me to be somewhat pessimistic as to the chances of success in this regard. I somehow don't think that Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin will prioritize ICC membership for their countries in the near future. Let me now turn to the thorny issue of Africa and the ICC. Africa is the continent with the highest number of state parties to the Rome Statute, with a total of 34. Moreover, 4 of the 16 serving judges at the ICC are from African state parties, not to mention the fact that the position of the prosecutor is also occupied by an African, Ms. Fatou Bensouda from the Gambia. It is also notable that much of the early support of the court came from African states. To date, 4 ICC state parties, Uganda, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, the Central African Republic, and Mali, all African states have referred situations occurring on their territories to the ICC. Indeed, all but 1 of the 9 situations currently before the court originate from the African continent. When the Georgian investigation was opened, many thought, finally, the ICC is out of Africa. With the recent announcement of African withdrawals, however, some cynics may well have thought, Africa is finally out of the ICC. So I'm going to come back to the issue of withdrawal shortly. Let me first discuss the relationship between Africa and the ICC more broadly. It is no secret that this relationship has not been straightforward. Some concern has been expressed by certain African states that the ICC's perceived almost exclusive focus on investigations and prosecutions in Africa to date suggests that the court is unfairly targeting Africa. We often hear that the ICC is the European Court for Africa, a reference to Western states' funding of the ICC. I personally do not share the view that the ICC is biased against Africa. Most African situations currently before the court have been self-referred. The fact that the Security Council referrals are also geographically located in Africa is an issue, but this is down to the balance of power before the Security Council, rather than an attempt to target Africa per se. Ultimately, the ICC must continue to be seen to investigate and prosecute without distinction all persons accused of committing the crimes under its jurisdiction, regardless of their location and nationality. Let me now turn to the issue of withdrawals. In late 2016, three states, Burundi, South Africa, and the Gambia, announced their intention to withdraw from the Rome Statute. Although saddening, legally, under the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties, states are entitled to withdraw from a treaty in accordance with the provision enshrined in that treaty. The procedure in the Rome Statute can be found in its Article 127. I do not wish to speculate on the reasons behind the intention of these states to withdraw. However, a desire to protect their leaders is evident in at least two of the above examples. In the case of South Africa, it seems to be a matter of internal politics, much to do with the Sudanese President al-Bashir's visit in 2015 and his departure from the country despite a court decision ordering his arrest pursuant to an ICC arrest warrant. Is leaving the ICC the answer to the state's problems? Certainly not. The answer, in my view, is staying within the ICC family and trying to find solutions from within through constructive dialogue and exchanges. As a glimmer of hope regarding the Gambians' withdrawal begins to shine through when, on Wednesday, newly elected President Barrow seemingly confirmed that they will not be withdrawing from the ICC after all, the African Union is scaling up its anti-ICC approach. In last week's African Union summit, the regional body did adopt an ICC withdrawal strategy. Despite its unfortunate name, the strategy does not actually call for mass withdrawal. Instead, it adopts a two-pronged approach, calling on more research to be done on the so-called collective withdrawals and outlines a timeline for proposed Rome Statute amendments, that is, reform. These amendments are what African Union members would like to see being agreed upon. They include, among other things, head of state or government immunity whilst in office. When I attended the Assembly of States Parties meeting in The Hague in November last year, I expected the mood to be somber. However, what I saw, besides the anticipated attacks towards the court, see for instance Burundi's statement in the general debate, was an effort on behalf of most other states, including many from Africa, to support the court in the delivery of its mandate, therefore reaffirming their commitment to the ICC. Even at the AU summit last week, those voices continued to be present. With a view to the future, if the ICC were to undertake all activities in a transparent and accountable manner, it would contribute to the restoration of trust in the court and to the strengthening of its legitimacy across the world, including also across Africa. The second challenge I wish to explore is that of independence, efficiency, and effectiveness of the court. For the court to become truly universal, its integrity ought to be preserved. A court's independence is one, if not the defining and distinguishing feature of a justice system operating in accordance with the rule of law. The independence of the ICC and its organs was an issue that was fought long and hard over and during the negotiations of the Rome Statute. Such independence permeates the entire Rome Statute, from the preamble to the obligations imposed upon the judges to ensure their independence. Not only is the office of the prosecutor independent from outside actors, but it is also independent from the other organs of the court. At the same time, there are concessions. For instance, the power of the Security Council to refer situations involving non-state parties under Article 13b of the statute, and its power to defer or suspend proceedings for up to a year, are two areas in which the independence of the court is qualified. While Article 13b of the Rome Statute opens up the possibility that the court may exercise jurisdiction over non-state parties, as we have seen in the case of Sudan or Libya, the question of when that jurisdiction may be invoked is subject to the high politics of the UN Security Council decision-making. See, for example, Syria. Equally important as actual independence is the perceived independence. In other words, the court and its organs must both be independent and be seen to be independent. The legitimacy of the ICC, the degree to which its investigations and trials and its decisions are accepted by those subject to its jurisdiction, depends to a large extent upon the degree to which the court is perceived to be independent. Challenges to the court's legitimacy in recent years demonstrate the role that independence plays in the course of promoting the universality and integrity of the statute and cooperation with the court. Critics of the court frequently raise the perception of bias to justify their action in respect to the court. The reason why any actor, state party, international organization, non-governmental organization, lends support to the ICC is so as to enable it to be effective in the fulfillment of its mandate. By pursuing the universality of the statute and preserving its integrity, and by encouraging cooperation with the court and implementing the principle of complementarity, these actors are contributing not only to the effectiveness and efficiency of the ICC specifically, but the effectiveness and efficiency of the Rome Statute system as a whole. Effectiveness can be measured in many, in a number of possible ways, but in general terms, each seeks to measure the extent to which the Rome Statute system fulfills its objectives. Effectiveness and efficiency are inextricably linked. The more efficient that the court is, the more effective it is, and the more credible it will be as a deterrent to the commission of international crimes in the future. At a more practical level, the ICC is increasingly expected to achieve more with less resources. Encouraging and supporting the court to improve its efficiency is all well and good. However, we need to ensure that the court's budget remains appropriate and does not lead to resource shortages that give rise to inefficiencies caused by capacity shortfalls. Insufficient resources ultimately impact upon the ability of the court to effectively carry out the activities necessary in order to deliver upon its mandate under the statute. While it is important that the court continues to make efficiency savings in its operation, it is necessary to consider whether the savings made are sufficient to absorb the cost of the increase in workload and whether savings made are in fact sustainable. Leaving discussions about money to one side, the third major challenge I would like to discuss today is that of cooperation between the ICC and states. The development of cooperation is, for the future of the court, a major challenge. Cooperation constitutes a key pillar for the proper functioning of the ICC and the international justice system established by the Rome Statute. The ICC has neither army nor police. The late Judge Antonio Cassese had said with regard to the ICTY something that rings true also with regard to the ICC. The tribunal remains very much like a giant without arms and legs. It needs artificial limbs to walk and work. And these artificial limbs are state authorities. If the cooperation of states is not forthcoming, the court cannot fulfill its functions. Only states can combine their efforts to investigate, facilitate the arrest and surrender of suspects to the court. As I see it, it is essential to develop three categories of cooperation. First, it is vital to strengthen bilateral cooperation, improving constructive dialogue between the court and the responsible national authorities. This also entails encouraging states to sign agreements on privileges and immunities, the relocation of witnesses, the protection of victims, and the enforcement of sentences for convicted detainees. A few words about victims here. The presence and participation of victims in the procedures before the ICC is essential to help rebuild their lives in the aftermath of mass crimes. Victim participation is one of the key attributes of the ICC. According to the Rome Statute system of justice, they must, without fear or apprehension, participate in trials at the ICC with their legal representatives to seek justice for the atrocities and suffering that they have endured. Facilitating their appearance, protection, and reparations is therefore key to the court's success. When it comes to cooperation and victims, relocation agreements are key in ensuring that victims and witnesses are better protected in a suitable geographical and cultural environment that serves to guarantee both their security and confidence. One of the most successful ICC relocations has been the case of a person who was given $50 to open a bike shop in his new country. Today, he has got 5 shops and he's doing rather well providing for himself and his family. However, not all such relocations have been easy or indeed successful. There are numerous examples where the protection has gone wrong or relocations have failed. Let me now turn to another key issue in strengthening the ICC regime. I would also like to emphasize the importance of states enacting national implementing legislation in universalizing the Rome Statute system. States who have ratified the Rome Statute must be encouraged to integrate core international crimes, as well as the provisions allowing for effective and efficient cooperation with the ICC, which is an obligation under the statute. To date, more than half of the state parties do not have cooperation legislation. Moreover, so far, there are only 76 parties to the Agreement of Privileges and Immunities of the ICC, and I believe 14 relocation agreements. This is an issue very close to my heart. We at Nottingham Human Rights Law Centre have had an ongoing commitment to national implementing legislation. Our centre has developed an expertise in this field over many years, developing the National Implementing Legislation database, part of the ICC's Legal Tools Project, which some of you may have seen or indeed used. At the request of the Hague Working Group on Cooperation, a new specialised database on cooperation legislation, the Judicial Assistance and Cooperation and Judicial Assistance Database, has been created as part of the CMN's ICJ Toolkits project and is now fully functional. I'm not arguing that legislation is the answer to the cooperation conundrum. Implementing legislation is simply the first step in achieving cooperation with the ICC. Having access to Legislation from other states is of great help to those states with materially less resources. CJUD acts as a central information hub, and I hope that national legislators, lawyers, prosecutors, academics, civil society, and others will be able to freely access it and see how states have interpreted the cooperation obligations. I have long argued in my work that international criminal justice is reliant upon building national capacity. It is my aspiration that we can help do that better in order to help the ICC in its work. Returning to cooperation challenges, it is also vital to strengthen cooperation between the ICC and non-state parties to ensure the universality of the court's enforcement action. It was very pleasing to note in this regard that it was the United States of America, a non-state party to the Rome Statute, that handed over LRA Commander Dominic Ongwen to the authorities in the Central African Republic, who then took the decision to surrender him to the ICC for trial in The Hague. Third, it is pivotal for the ICC to build upon its pre-existing multifaceted cooperation with international civil society, such as the Commonwealth, human rights and humanitarian organizations, victims associations and regional organizations. There's a lot still to be done on cooperation. Tackling non-cooperation, for example, is also a key issue. The treaty basis of the ICC does not provide much ammunition in that respect. An inevitable fault in the institutional design of the court, you might say. Moving away from cooperation, the fourth major challenge on which I now wish to turn is that of strengthening complementarity. I would like to recall that the ICC can and should only be a court of last resort against impunity. It does not replace the work of national jurisdictions. Each state must be able to adjudicate, in all sovereignty, crimes committed on its territory, including those under the jurisdiction of the ICC. Indeed, states, by ratifying the Rome Statute, have neither abandoned nor restricted their sovereignty. On the contrary, it is the primary responsibility of all ICC state parties to investigate and prosecute the authors of the most serious crimes. The Rome Statute is based on the principle of complementarity. This gives priority of action to national courts and limits the jurisdiction of the ICC to cases where there is clear unwillingness or inability to act. While willingness is essentially a matter of politics, the ability of states to investigate and prosecute core international crimes depends largely on its institutional capacity and preparedness. It is evident that the success of the ICC should not be assessed through the volume of cases pending before it, but rather by the exponential growth of matters within the jurisdiction in national courts. Assessing mass atrocity before national courts offers multiple advantages. Internalizing the responsibility to investigate and prosecute crimes under national law slowly builds on domestic culture of justice and the rule of law. As we know, national procedures can have a great societal impact, especially for the victims of core international crimes. The experience of the ad hoc tribunals for the former Yugoslavia and Rwanda, the examples provided by the work of the ICC until now, as well as the proceedings of hybrid tribunals such as the Special Court for Sierra Leone and the Special Tribunal for Lebanon, have demonstrated the concrete limitations of a justice process that is both geographically and temporally remote from the societies that have experienced and were victims of violence. National and even local trials are more visible and comprehensible by the affected population, and they are usually seem more legitimate to the local communities, at least. We must also take into consideration that the ICC cannot deal with each and every situation. The court has finite resources and it is usually detached from the territories on which atrocities take place. This poses a number of problems in gathering and accessing evidence, approaching witnesses and ensuring their safety, as well as achieving the visibility that is often needed to bring closure to the victims. It is not a common following mass atrocity that national jurisdictions lack the necessary operational capacity to address the complex and numerous crimes committed within a specific context. Domestic capacity of states dealing with the aftermath of mass atrocity is significantly reduced. There are a number of challenges that are common in such contexts. I have already discussed the issue of lack of national legislation implementing the Rome Statute when I talked about cooperation. Allow me to indulge a bit more on that and add one more thing in that respect. The absence of specific legislation addressing core international crimes as such might lead to their investigation and prosecution as ordinary crimes. While not legally problematic, ordinary crimes lack the stigma of the core international crimes and may not carry the same significance in the eyes of the victims, perpetrators, and the wider international community. Moreover, the elements of international crimes are far more complex than those of ordinary domestic law crimes. They therefore require legislation that is highly precise and adapted to the grave nature and complexity of international crimes. The situation is further exacerbated by the lack of necessary infrastructure that is common in post-conflict and transitional societies. A criminal justice system does not require only laws, but also courtrooms, detention and imprisonment centers, as well as properly trained and experienced personnel such as judges, police investigators, etc. Building national capacity to deal with mass atrocity is therefore key to the success of the system put forward by the Rome Statute. The emergence of the concept of positive complementarity has been seen by many as the solution to the absence of a legal basis in the statute to ensure comprehensive assistance with building that sort of capacity. The initial concept first appeared in an OTP 2006 report on prosecutorial strategy, and it was used to describe the active encouragement of states to conduct national proceedings and, where appropriate, to provide the necessary assistance to enable them to do so. Until 2010, the notion of positive complementarity was perceived only as a prosecutorial strategy. In the view of the OTP, positive complementarity encourages genuine national proceedings where possible, relies on national and international networks, and participates in a system of international cooperation. Positive complementarity received a lot of attention ahead and during the first review conference in Kampala in 2010. A resolution adopted at the conference transformed what was the common understanding of positive complementarity until then and changed its character from a purely prosecutorial strategy to the basis for encouraging capacity building. Recognizing that the ICC is not a development agency, something we heard a lot during the review conference, the onus for developing such capacity building was shifted at the review conference from the court to all activities, actions, whereby national jurisdictions are strengthened and enabled to conduct genuine national investigations and trials of crimes included in the Rome Statute without involving the court in capacity building, financial support, and technical assistance, but instead leaving these actions and activities for states to assist each other on a voluntary basis. End of quote. Positive complementarity therefore focuses on the technical and financial assistance provided to states in order to build their capacity to oversee investigations and prosecutions of core international crimes. This means strengthening both the expertise and capacity of domestic legal actors, including judges, prosecutors, lawyers, clerks and security forces. It is only when national legal actors are familiar with international norms that the guarantees of fair and equitable trial can be ensured. I hope that you will agree with me that national jurisdictions are very important in ensuring the success of the ICC regime. And I hope that I have highlighted some of the issues that have emerged so far. In my journey of the court's life to date, I chose to focus on what I consider to be the four major challenges. They are by no means the only ones: universality, independence, efficiency and effectiveness, cooperation and complementarity have left a hallmark on the court's record. It is beyond doubt that the first 15 years of the ICC have been remarkable in the world of international criminal justice. As the enthusiasm of the early years subsides, one thing is clear: the ICC is entering the era of pragmatism. The past 15 years saw some fascinating developments, quite a few achievements, and many, many challenges. It is time to reflect upon them, consider how to support and improve the ICC and the Rome system of justice as a whole. I sometimes like to think of the international criminal justice system as a reflection of the solar system. In this, the ICC occupies the position of the sun. Other courts and tribunals are the sun's satellites. While the ICTY and the ICTR are heading towards extinction, new stars are being born. See, for instance, the Kosovo Tribunal, whose composition has just been announced. In my version of this solar system, national courts are more like the Earth, looking up to the sun, the ICC. What we need to ensure is that the sun, the court, continues to shine and that the Earth does not get scorched. International criminal justice and international criminal law continued to dominate headlines. Whilst the ICC may seem to be in crisis, I am sure that it is not the case of a falling star. In any case, the ride over the first 15 years has been thrilling, if a bit bumpy. I look forward to what the next 15 years have in store for the ICC. Thank you.